Today is Tuesday, July 13th, 1999. This is Peggy Van Skoik, and for the second time, I am in the home of Carl Mills, Jr. We're here today to continue with information about Mr. Mills' life. So, Mr. Mills.
Thank you very much. There's a feeling that an excellent athletic program can and will support academic programs. I was fortunate to have Simon Terrell as the athletic director, who has just recently retired from the High School Athletic Association, as a coach. And so from Simon Terrell through Edward Lane, and Ed is retired as a principal at school that they now are rebuilding near the center, shopping center. Oh well. We had a history of merit scholars, Morehead scholars, and the feeling was that something should be done to upgrade the athletic program. So under Mr. Terrell's leadership, athletic eligibility, academic eligibility, was raised from 70 to 75. The feeling was that this would give a message to the kids that thought all above 70 was wasted as far as academic average goes. To begin with, we lost two all-conference football players, a quarterback and a lineman. But from that point on, we had less students, almost no students being declared ineligible due to academics. Probably the program that benefited most was the basketball program. Since there was three grading periods covering the basketball season, there were three chances to lose players. And from this point on, we had no loss.
Do you think that by raising the minimum standards, those 5 points, it motivated the kids to do better?
It did.
Excellent.
That's the viewpoint the administration took anyway. I still can't come up with the name of the school.
I'm sorry, I can't either.
It's under renovation right now. It's right there at the shopping center. Okay. Another key to academics is the media program. And we think in terms of the library. Under the leadership of the late Edna Wilkins, who worked with me at Terry High School and later at Wake County as the chief librarian. This became a key to the instructional program, the way the librarians worked within the program. Later on, they became a key factor in the initiation of the county's computer-assisted educational program, where there seemed to be a bigger tie with a computer, and we did not have the type computers they have now. We had bought into an old GE-265. Raleigh bought a unit, Wake bought one, Rocky Mount bought one, Wilson, Kings Mountain, and so on. The key person should have been the mathematics people. But we got more cooperation and more assistance from librarians throughout the county to use the program. Now you've got to understand that this was a new concept back in that day.
Do you recall when it was that you bought that computer?
We bought it about in the early 70s, about 1973.
That was pretty early.
Just prior to merger of Wake and Raleigh public schools. Yes, the old GE-265 was housed in Raleigh. It took an entire hallway. The slave or the thing that did the work was just a monster. And at that time, it was used sort of like a series or a stack of records where the computer would go through the stack and pick out what was needed for the particular program. So it would have taken about two small rooms plus a hallway to house a computer. Later on, the media specialists became quite helpful to the startup of the Life Experiences program out at South Hills. They were so involved in the instructional program, all phases of it, that they also became involved with the mentally challenged element of the student body.
When you began using the computer, did you only use it for administrative purposes to run the school, or did you actually offer it to the students to use?
It was offered to the students.
It was?
Mm-hmm.
How did they use it in the beginning?
I guess the term is computer assisted instruction. Students came to a center like the library and work with a computer. Pretty much on an individual basis under the direction of the librarian. Sometimes she could work with a half dozen, but the most work was done with the individual student. Now, this was prior to the administration getting involved with the computer. About a year or two later, Wake County bought into a computer. It was located at Noble Road, and this was a thing that helped us make a lot of headway in terms of the business aspects of the school system, keeping records, numbers, and that sort of thing. Another interesting highlight was the organization of the Band Boosters. The band, through a series of directors, starting with Dr. Jack White, who later went to one of the nearby colleges as a director, and coming through Jimmy Burns as a director. It was a very forward-looking group of band persons, and we were able to get a band booster group started, and it's so active today, very active. That's pretty much the tie-ins with the school situation. My life as a educator and carrier was fairly well balanced, in that I was a member of the First Baptist Church in Cary, and was an ordained deacon and taught a Sunday school class for a number of years. We gave housing to the Baptist Church on two occasions at what was in Cary Elementary and Junior High when building projects were underway at the church. So, the things that involved me a good bit was the activities on a church level. Now, remember, this was also taking place the time integration came along. And I'm afraid the Baptists were not too fond of integration as far as the congregation was concerned. But this was kind of an internal situation that perhaps the congregation was not too aware of. Among the deacons, for example, as they discussed how they would greet minority races at the front door, side doors, the feeling was that they may not be as welcome as we'd like for them to be. But to me, integration was a law of the land, and I took the same attitude that we did with public school, that it's something we need to work out and not really fight too much. Incidentally, no minority race people attempted to attend services at that particular time, and so it wasn't really a problem, but to hear the deacons talk, they were just not going to be too cordial. A couple showed up. That's a thumbnail description, I guess, of how my church life sort of tied in with the school and the community.
That you had mentioned something about taking over the ham biscuit concession at the state fair, and there was a tie-in there with integration. Is that true?
Well, at the same time, the Methodist churches had a ham biscuit project at the state fair. This happened to be a major fundraising situation for the Methodists, and as they seemed to want to, well, they definitely want to give it up until everything sort of cleared out as far as the racial situation was concerned. The Lions Club came in and sort of took over the management of the ham biscuit. But since the major membership of the Lions Club was Baptist and Methodist, the Methodists were still involved individually. But at that time, we used some funds that we got from the project to buy what is now part of Lions Park out near the high school.
That you raised by selling the biscuits?
Biscuits, uh-huh. The only encounter I had there was first night I was on duty, I was kind of a waiter. A black couple came in and said hello, what would you have? And the comment was, you mean you would serve us? I said, sure, your money's as good as anybody else's. So they got up and walked out of them.
They left without buying anything?
They just wanted to see if they could. And so,
did that happen very often in those days?
Well, that was just the first fall, and the schools wound up integration. And I guess the major part of the Southern attitude was, we don't really know how to handle a situation. We'd rather have things status quo instead of changing to some other social order. Is there anything else I should comment on about that?
Later on, did the church see minority people coming to worship?
It's just unfortunate, but the 11 o'clock hour among the churches is the most segregated period of time in the week. Very few whites are, well, there are not many large Negro churches in here, one to be certain about on Highway 54. But among the black residents, they just don't seem to want to attend a white congregation.
And there are black churches in Cary.
There's one major black one.
That they would prefer.
And several. There's one out near West Cary Middle School. But the major part of the blacks want to attend their church. And as I say, that's the most segregated hour of the week. And I'm using 11 o'clock to 12 o'clock. But wherever you find, say, 9 o'clock services, 10:30 services, 11 o'clock or so on, the integration is just not there. And as we overlook the three services at the First Baptist Church now, very seldom will you find a black couple or individual. And they're likely to be from a college, from a show or from St. Augustine.
Hmm.
Or maybe a black student at a state university.
Were there ever any incidences that you know of at the Cary Baptist Church where there was tension or any kind of altercations?
No real tension, except again, the feeling that we don't want to interrupt the status quo. And my comment to the Baptist deacons when it came my turn, and remember, Dad Dunham was chairman of the board most of those 4 years, and so he was a calming influence. My comment to the deacon, the board, was that I would ask the black couple or the black individual came to the door, did you come to worship? And if they said yes, I'd see them anywhere they wanted to be seated in the auditorium. But I had this comment to make also, if they came just to see if they could get in, I was going to invite them to go down to the Methodist Church on the corner to pay them a visit. So the only tension would be opposition to a change in status quo. Okay, that's covered a lot of territory, but I got some personal gain out of the situation. As you look at this house, for example, Oates Construction Company, I think you see their signs occasionally throughout the town. Oates, reacted to a request to bill, and we worked out a cost-plus basis rather than just a hard and fast contract type thing for the construction of this. And at that time, I discovered that kids who in former years had been advised that they had to leave Cary to find employment, since it was, we're going from zero banks to one bank to what it looks like now. There just were no employment opportunities for youngsters. So those that went off to college or those that went off to attend trade school stayed where they were because there was no opportunity. But I noticed as Oaks built the house for me, he was picking up subs that were former Cherokee people, so they were beginning to find opportunities in the county or in the city. And the reason I want to bring that up is that I put a lot of effort into the life of the community, school, recreation, what have you, but in return, I got, I found excellent situations formed by people that were in the Little League program, were in the recreation program. Now, where'd I go from here? I guess this is a good time to summarize my relationship with the city, my relationship with the school. As we worked in the school system, for example, being able to recognize people that could play a key role in the development of whatever I was involved in. And I mentioned, as far as the athletic program, the contributions of Simon Terrell and a number of coaches through Edward Lane. They were able to play an important role in the development of that particular thing. And as far as the band boosters are concerned, the music program, it was people like Jack White, a number of band directors right through Jimmy Burns that made the band program outstanding. And again, the willingness of the Cherokee people to finance programs that they saw some future in.
The Cherokee band program has evolved into such an internationally recognized group. Did it start out as a very small grassroots group when you were principal? Did you watch that grow from seedlings, if you will?
I would have to say that originally the band boosters had two or three beginning points. It did not seem that it was going to be successful. Mm. And then all of a sudden, when Jack White got on the scene, and later with the various band instructors, it caught fire. And we started out with a band-aid approach where bands came in from various parts of the Southeast, really. Came in from Virginia and from North and South Carolina, Georgia. They brought with them terrific band programs, marching bands primarily. But then we developed a halftime type thing at Cooper Field. This gave people a chance to see something besides marching. And then later we got into concert situations, and so music became a pretty well balanced program. And we removed ourselves from competition, and I must admit that from my point of view, we were picking up an awful lot of things from bands coming in from throughout the Southeast. One good example is Elizabeth City. They had a financial person that was able to put a lot of money into the program. It took a half a dozen vans to bring up the equipment they had. And when the Cary people saw that sort of thing, it sort of made them want to do as well. Now, of course, Elizabeth City has lost the support they had back then, and so the only programs that come up to the Cary standard now would be like Apex, which was a part of Cary. And you see the same thing happened at nearby schools in the county. That's about it. Unless you have something else that you want to.
Well, I guess to summarize, from the things that began when you were involved in the school to present day, and then looking to the future, what do you see may evolve from some of the things that started when you were principal of the school? And where do you see those things going in the future?
It's such a different day. When I had the support of the Cary Advisory Council, and they were very important, the local people did a lot of things on their own. Presently, I see too much dependence on the county administration. Now again, the advisory council is important, but I don't think they're quite as powerful as the advisory councils of the 1950s and 60s. The feeling was that the Cary people were willing to finance the best academic program in the area, the best athletic program in the area. And the same thing applied to various features of the town.
Do you think that's still true today?
Well, it takes a different turn. There's an awful lot of initiative on the part of the recreation people in Cary. And of course, that doesn't have the strong tie-in with the county. I have a feeling that in too many cases, the initiative is coming out of the Board of Education. And perhaps that's the way it ought to be. But when the board acts the way it's acting now, there's very little room for the local initiative that was true in the 50s and 60s.
So it's a very different political climate than it was then, and governing climate.
In many, many instances, as far as the school was concerned, I could get accomplished things that I dreamed about by personal initiative in that particular area. Where my colleagues seemed to want the county to furnish things for them. As far as the future is concerned, I hate to see what's happening with the county board and the county commissioners, and that the commissioners raise the money and the board decides how it's going to be spent. The recent bond issue is an example of people turning down the bond issue, by a big margin. And yet, the county commissioner is coming right back and coming up with a plan. And then we're having to take another look at, in terms of, they realize that the initiative at the local level is very, very important. The population, when they turn down something, are going to thwart any effort to bypass a decision. But we've seen this example in the very recent past, and also the very merger of the Raleigh system and the Roy County system, that the people in both city and county had denied on two votes merger, and politically it was, they were merged through the House members that had no gave no representation to the county, as opposed to backing a proposal to merge based on what the city of Raleigh wanted. One thing that had its effect back then was there were very few minority race people in the county. Raleigh had reached a point where more than half their students were minority. And I think in Cary, for example, it might have been half a dozen minority race people in the whole attendance area. Of course, the Cary citizens didn't want to see change. They didn't know any other way of life. But they were willing to accept it and work down, work things out for themselves. In Raleigh, there was a feeling that we better go slow and take immigration on a pace that we could learn to live with and not have a backlash of reaction from the citizens. Now, I think I missed a point or two that you're trying to make.
Well, I think you covered a lot of points there.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Well, thank
you.
And
I wish that you can tell I'm a little bit hoarse. And it was about the same way a couple weeks ago when you came through. So I don't have the smoothness of speaking that I would like to have, but
oh, but your words are coming through loud and clear, and we just, again, truly appreciate your time and effort that you're making, and all this information is just invaluable to us, so we really appreciate it.
We have not been too involved in schools since my retirement, but bits and pieces here and there, like your life experiences out at South Hills. This was a takeoff for a graduate program from the public school setup. And so, again, the people of Cary started the program to simply give those challenged kids an opportunity beyond the school level for some type of employment, meaningful employment. And it was a case of Mary Atkins, who I hope you interview from that standpoint. She and of course the support you got from the late Jim Atkins, who was on the Board of Education at that time, has helped to make that program good.
It has been a successful program.
I'm still pretty much involved there. We We're currently trying to raise funds for a capital improvement type thing. We've rented long enough. We need a facility of our own.
Now, it has been in existence for quite some time.
About 30 years now.
That's quite a while.
Let's see. Yeah.
What kind of success rate have they shown?
Well, there's just a waiting list. We can never handle the number of people. And there is a portion or a certain part of the population that really can't understand why a program employing people can't be self-supported. But the participants are tested from time to time, and their productivity as bakers, as whatever, growing alfalfa sprouts, their ability to work is tested in reference to what the normal person can do. And it doesn't come close sometimes. But they learn and they progress. So now we're able to establish a pay schedule in keeping with their ability.
Do the people tend to go on to other jobs in other industries once they've been trained there?
Some do. But the purpose of life experiences is not to put them in employment situations. I guess you could put it this way, that the purpose of life experiences is to establish an atmosphere in which a mentally handicapped person can they can successfully pursue work experiences.
That's wonderful. How many people do they employ right now?
We have about 25.
And it's primarily food related industry?
Food related is what we started with. We now have a janitorial or custodial service. Some churches, some organizations, some buildings use that service. And we have a thrift shop. And so there is, within the bounds of opportunities, something for almost everyone.
Where's the thrift shop?
It's at South Hills.
It is at South Hills.
It's across from the inn. And it's where a hairstyling organization was located at one time. You can see the sign from as you come in from Cary, come into Cary from the Beltline. That's life experiences. It's all at one location now. But our handicap is that we have to conform to the structure rather than being able to have a structure that we can adapt to the needs of the participants. I guess I've got to make one other comment. One thing that sold me on that group was a young man had just gone into the program. He'd just gone through his training period, and he was getting his first check. And it was $7 for a week's work. He was the happiest individual I think I've ever seen. I just happened to go in the bank when he was in there with his mother. He presented his check to the teller to be cashed, and she played along real well with the situation and says, "Young man, how would you like to have it?" He says, "Tens and twenties will be all right." No concept of what $7 would be.
But he had earned it himself.
Yeah, first money he'd earned. And at that time, he immediately went to a nearby store and bought a shirt, and the next Monday he was the proudest owner of something that he had bought himself with his own money.
That's a wonderful story.
Okay, the name of the school is Adams Elementary. We're trying to come up with.
I'm glad you've thought of that.
And this is where, after a long period of time as an athletic coach, Ed Lane became principal of Adams, and he would be another source of local information you'd want on a number of things. The academic, the athletic, and of course Simon Terrell is retired at Chapel Hill, but he would be a source if you had time to go to Chapel Hill and seek an interview with him.
Great.
And young Adams, who was quarterback on one of Simon Terrell's teams in Cary, went into a system several years ago, and with Terrell's retirement, Adams is now the High School Athletic Association head person. He's just finished up a year as national president, or national director of high school groups. So he's another source of information.
Great. That's wonderful.
I'm sorry I can't give you a good lead into the media people, because unfortunately we lost Ed Lorenz about 3 years ago.
Oh, that's too bad.
But you can get a, well, so many of those librarians have retired. Be hard to get a feel for those, their activities.
Great.
Thank
well,
you very much.
Again, thank you. This was just very, very helpful for us, and we, again, really appreciate all of your time.